This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ever listen to this? Ever listen to this?
Interest rates are higher. I know people don't like that, but you should be welcoming a stronger economy.
And maybe Yield has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
The United States is a country that has always paid all of its bills.
Lannister always pays his debts.
Don't let the bastards get you.
Hello and welcome to Comedian versus Economist. We demystify the world of money and help you get a handle on the bigger picture. My name's Adam and we're joined as always by my little older brother and real life economist, Thomas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, g'day, Adam. How are you going?
Doing well, thank you, Thomas. I just inflected older there a little bit because it was your birthday yesterday. So happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
For yesterday. Sorry I didn't call. I just figured we'd probably talk enough as it is.
So. Yeah.
No, I didn't want to overdo it.
Yeah, no, that's probably the best gift you could give me. radio silence.
I am happy to speak a bit louder and a bit slower, if you'd like, from now on. Although judging by the fact that you're wearing sunglasses inside at lunchtime, I think maybe you might like me to speak a bit slower and a bit quieter.
Yeah, a bit duller. I did have a bender yesterday, actually. That said, it is a particularly bright day here in the office.
Inside. very good. All right. Well, let's crack on. Very special show coming up for you today. There's always so much going on in the world. Well, to hell with the world. The world can wait because this show is all about you. We've picked out a bunch of your questions over the last couple of weeks. Thank you for your patience. I know we've been saying that we're going to get to them, but we found that we had quite a few. So we decided to dedicate the entire show today to answering your questions. Thank you for taking the time to write to us. I know it's not exactly dipping the quill and a trip to the post office anymore, but still it is very much appreciated. This will as well be our final show for a couple of weeks as we take a break to try and survive the school holidays. So without further ado, starting with Jason, and Jason sent us a message via Instagram at CVE Podcast. He's asking about whether the RBA might pause rates now. He said real monthly inflation is still up 0.2%. So does the RBA go further with interest rate hikes because this new inflation value falls within the RBA's happy range of 2 to 3% per annum? Are they likely to pause? Thomas, interest rate announcement will be yesterday if you're listening to this on Wednesday, tomorrow for us as we record. So, Thomas, where does the RBA go from here?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Markets are balanced. They're not sure. It's not a clear signal. CBA economists reckon that the board meeting is live. Which
what does that mean?
Well,
it's not pre-recorded.
Yeah. Now there was an issue with the governor lip syncing his board presentations. A few months ago.
Oh, Pilo.
Pilo. Yeah. I mean, largely they had the pyrotechnics were so good you could kind of just forgive it. But
Yeah.
Now, I mean, it means it's live in the sense like they will actually be discussing it. So like previously it's like we're hiking, the board meets, are we still hiking? Yep, we're still hiking, great. But this time CBA saying it would be a live meeting in the sense that they'll actively be discussing it and there'll be different opinions in the room. Yeah, and it's interesting. And Jason picked out an interesting point there, which I don't know if is well understood, but we got 0.2% CPI in the month. And you can more or less annualize that by just multiplying that by 12. It's not exactly just multiplying that by 12, but, more or less.
0.2 times 12 being 2.4. So that's smack bang.
Smack bang
in the range.
In the range. In the happy range, as he says. Mm. Yeah. So it was weak at 0.2%. Markets were expecting 0.6%. Big dip in the annual rate to 6.8%. And you combine that with the partial indicators like prices in the NAB business survey and in the PMI survey, it's looking pretty clear now that inflation peaked back in December and we're on the way down.
Back in December?
Mm.
So we're late to this party.
Well, you need a couple of months to understand that you only know you've hit a peak in with the benefit of hindsight.
Right, okay. So
yeah, I mean we've only had two falls in a row now with this headline CPI is lower 2 months in a row. So that's sort of something of a trend, but probably, you know, you combine that with the partial indicators and think like, yeah, looks like we're softening now.
So what do you reckon is going to happen to put yourself on record?
I reckon they're going to hike. I'm not high conviction on that, but I think they're going to hike. I think they're going to want to see.
Is some of that about the perception we talked about as well, about looking strong? Like I think Jason even mentioned, you know, would they look weak if they don't continue to raise rates?
Yeah, I think so. Like there's a chance now where everyone's questioning, well, how committed is the RBA here?
Mm.
How staunch are they going to be?
Mm.
There's an opportunity to come out and go like, yeah, we're staunch. We are so committed to killing inflation. Like we don't care what else happens. You know, there's an opportunity this month to send a really strong message, and my sense is they'll take it. But yeah, it could go the other way too.
Equally, though, wouldn't the RBA be interested in doing the right thing as opposed to just blindly ploughing ahead, a la 6 to 12 months ago?
Don't
they need some? Like, I mean, I get they need to be staunch.
Mm.
I'm not sure if that's their motto, but. Don't they also need to be seen to be doing the right thing and being responsible and responding to changing conditions?
Yes. But, I mean, it's slowing, but it's at 6.8%. So there's still quite a long way from 6.8 to 2.5.
Yeah.
Chris Joy had an awesome interview on the Equity Mates podcast last week. Mm. And he's saying, like, markets are seem to be pricing in that once we break the back of inflation, it's just a straight line down to back to 2.5%.
Mm.
And saying, like, that might happen, but it might also happen that inflation drops down to 4.5% and gets stuck there, where you're still above the RBA's target band, but you come off the highs, but you're not back in the band.
Mm.
And the RBA may need to respond to that with another hike.
Right. So, and maybe it's a case too of just making the least worst decision. Like if they did pause, or, you know, they're not going to cut rates, but if they did pause, that turns out to be bad, then it looks really bad later on. Whereas if they just went with another 0.25,
it's not great.
No one's going to like it, but it's kind of like, well, it's not, you know, it's not going to end badly in 6 months.
Yeah. Well, more you look back and just be like, well, it was the 11th in a row. Mm. Maybe the last three were unnecessary. You know, like.
God, I hate economics. Seems so. We overshot it by four rate rises. Like there's no material impact to households and everyone else who's got a mortgage just going like, what? You accidentally did three or four too many rate rises and just accidentally cost us all thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
All right, Thomas, next up we've got Simon and Ella. They bailed you up around a campfire, if I'm not mistaken, but did have an interesting question, which we thought was probably something that other people would want to hear about. So they're looking to buy their first house. And really weighing up whether they should buy now or wait.
Mm.
Obviously, we're not providing financial advice if you're thinking about buying a home, whether you should or you shouldn't. But, yeah, got any thoughts on whether now is perhaps a good time to be buying a house?
Yeah. So without not wanting to offer financial advice at all, but the things I'd be thinking about in that question right now is that CoreLogic data says that prices have turned. We got 0.6% rise in capital city house prices in March.
Right.
Because it's such a broad data set, it tends to be doesn't give you false signals too often. So the fact that it's turned does suggest we're at least moving into some kind of period of rising house prices, which has caught everyone in the market by surprise. Everyone thought we had further to run to the downside.
Because we had a massive spike sort of during COVID through the pandemic when money was cheap.
Yeah.
So house prices went gangbusters, but then they seemed like they sort of were going to head back down again and did head down for a while. But you're saying they may have arrested that fall a bit early.
Yeah, I think everyone was like probably the sort of the central forecast was for around a 15% decline off those peaks. And we probably had like a bit less than 10. So it does seem to be turning a bit early. But there's a real absence of stock in the market. So you know we have data on how many houses are available for sale right now, and there's not many. There's sellers are holding off, and we're not seeing any forced sales yet. That's often what drives price declines is when people are like, okay, I can't carry this mortgage anymore. I need to get out.
But don't we have the mortgage cliff that we're all fast approaching?
Yes, that's right. So the property market is often surprisingly strong. Like it's consistently outperforms expectations the 20 years I've been watching it. So it might be the case that we've hit a turning point and it's just prices are on the move from here, and there's because there is such strong demand for property and prices keep pushing higher. On the downside scenario is you've got this mortgage cliff coming up where people moving from the fixed rates of like 2% that they got during COVID will be refinancing at like 6%. So that's a big shift. Some of those people might be like, oh, that's too much. I'm going to bail out. I'm going to sell the property. Maybe that happens. So that's on the way. We've also got Christopher Kent, who's the assistant governor of financial markets at the RBA, came out a couple of weeks ago with an interesting stat saying he reckons that so far only about 1.85 percentage points of the rate hikes we've seen, of the 300 odd, almost 300, has gone through into the markets. The rest is still in train because of the lags. So even though we've had close to 300 basis points of hikes, the market's only felt 1.85 percentage points of that. And so there's still more to come. So you've got the fixed rate cliff plus this lagged effect coming through. So that's, you know, that's weighing to the downside. On top of that is Chris Joy's scenario he's talking about where inflation doesn't get back into the target band and gets stuck somewhere, you know, 4 or 5%, and the RBA then hikes again. And this has happened in the past where the RBA has paused a hike cycle, waited to see how things panned out and gone, actually, we need to hike again. There's a scenario there where the rate cliff plays out, the lag rate hikes finally make their way into the economy, plus we get another round of rate hikes. And in that scenario, I think it's quite, you know, feasible to then see prices fall another 15% from where they are now.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but then how do you balance out those two scenarios, and which one do you think is more likely? There's a lot of art in that question. And the other thing on the demand side is the rental market's a nightmare right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, so it's one thing to be considering your purchase of the house, but it's another thing to be thinking about like what your current, it's a lot's going to depend on what your current situation is. Like if you're renting or if you're looking for a rental, as opposed to maybe you're living at home and living at home's not, you don't have the same kind of the rental or rent pressures that you would have if you were in the rental market. So probably a lot of that comes into it too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, we've got a record surge of immigration this year. The rental market is super tight. There's never been more people looking to get out of the rental market than there are right now.
Right.
You know, there's really strong demand coming from renters. And that's probably why we're not seeing those forced sales, because, like, you know, if you can't afford your mortgage payments, you can't afford rent probably, you know. You can't sell out of your home and start renting because the rental prices are just so crazy. So demand is really strong. We know that. Maybe there is a scenario where prices take another leg lower, but there is also a scenario where they have hit the turning point and they just sort of shuffle on up from here.
Right. Well, hopefully that's useful for you, Simon Heller. I think the key takeaway there is you should just move back in with your parents.
Yeah.
Come on, kids. All right, next up, we've got a question from James, who sent us a message via Instagram or Facebook at CVE Podcast. He was looking at Phil and his cronies.
Staunch posse.
Staunch posse. I love it. Phil and his cronies handed us another rate hike last week. Seemed to have left the door open to pause it there. This seems at odds to the position taken by the US Fed, and it seems like they will continue to hike. Please tell me if I've got this right. If they hike and we don't, that should affect our currency, i.e. the price of AUD is cheaper relative to the USD. If that's the case, it's a grim story for importers and might contribute in some way to inflation in Australia, as many firms would rely on import goods and services and additional costs could be passed on. So he says, I guess my question is, if that's the case, how much of an impact would this have? How much do we care? James, if I could answer the second part of that question, I don't care much at all. Thomas, how much do you care? And how much of an impact would this have?
So what we're talking about is the interest rate differential. That's the term we call. So you can look at the US has its cash rate, which then affects the interest rates on all assets in the economy. Aussie has its cash rate, which affects all assets there. So if there's other things being equal, if the US hikes and increases interest rates that all US assets are paying, and the RBA doesn't hike and doesn't increase the return that Aussie assets are paying, then there's more demand for US assets relative to Australian assets because they're now paying more. Right. That makes sense. So because there's more demand for US assets and you need to buy US assets with US dollars, that pushes up demand for US dollars, drives down demand for Aussie dollars. And as demand falls, then the price of Aussie dollars falls in US dollars.
Right.
The direction of what he's talking about is right, that if the US, if the RBA hadn't hiked at all this cycle and the US had added 500 basis points, that would have, smashed the Aussie dollar, definitely. And that does make things harder for importers. And then that feeds through into inflation. So it is, it is something that the governor talks about from time to time. They do watch what happens with the Aussie dollar because that does impact the inflation story quite directly.
So how much differential do you need then to see a difference or to see an impact? Like you said 500 basis points, is that it? Like if they did 500 basis points in rises and we did nothing, that's kind of when you'd start to see the impact? Or could we see it at if the RBA pauses, say, on tomorrow or yesterday, but the Fed keeps hiking, then is that enough to see an impact?
I think you definitely see it at 500 basis points. Where, I mean, the thing that foreign exchange markets are very deep and very liquid, and they're also very future leveraged. So people trade. There's futures on currencies. There's also futures on commodities, which are, drives a lot of the foreign exchange trade. And so there's exchange prices really reflect the collective market's view of where the future's going and what's going on and a whole bunch of other things. To try and pull out some element is really hard. At some point you're definitely going to see it, 500 basis points, for sure you're going to see that. But, one or two, it's really hard to know. And how big that impact is, I think people have probably tried to study it. I don't think when I was at the bank, I don't think I've heard of a hard and fast rule that X basis points translates to 10% downward pressure on the Aussie or something. I never heard of a rule of thumb.
There's not a big button at the RBA that someone pushes when we get to 500. We've pushed the button. Phil orders his cronies. Push it. Okay. Well, yeah. Hopefully that answers your question, James.
Yeah, it's a factor. How much do we care? It's a bit hard to know. It's a bit hard to know. I think at the margins, it doesn't affect it too much, but it's definitely part of the mix.
I feel like this is this is why we get into so much trouble, because the markets and currency markets and whatever are all future looking, and economists are all backwards looking. I feel like maybe there's some work we could do as a society to get everyone looking in the same direction. I don't know. I'm new at this. All right, why don't we take a break here, grab a quick word from this week's sponsor, and we'll be back after the break with questions from Christian, another Jason, and Kim. Look forward to talking to you right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back. You're on Comedian versus Economist. We are reading your listener questions this week before we take a couple of weeks holidays. Thanks for sending them all in. If you'd like to send us a question, you can email us, cve@equitymates.com, or hit us up via Instagram and Facebook at CVE Podcast. Thomas, Christian sent us an email, cve@equitymates.com. Christian's asking, last episode you mentioned SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, collapse was enabled because of Trump's policy of not insuring the smaller banks. My question is, what was this policy originally supposed to do/prevent? Thomas, what was Trump's policy?
So what happened was, like, after the global financial crisis, there was sort of a coordinated global push to strengthen financial systems. And that meant for the big banks, it meant increasing their capital requirements, which is sort of like the amount of liquid assets and high quality liquid assets they have at hand to deal with some sectors of the economy falling over or certain asset classes collapsing. You get the banks to hold some liquid, high quality liquid assets, and that means that they can deal with the turbulence.
Yeah.
There was the Basel III agreements or something, is what they're called. And that meant that they had to keep more capital on hand.
Okay.
The thing that happens though with the bank is that the more capital you're required to hold to protect yourself, the less that you can lend out. And the less that you can lend out, the less money you're making,
right?
Because that's your business. You make money lending money out. So if you've got to hold on to it, you make less money.
Yep.
And so what happened is that, well, the world signed off on these Basel agreements. They were to be introduced for the American banking system. But then the community banks and the U.S. banking sector is quite unique in the sense that, like, there's a lot more banks per person. Just a large number of banks there. And the community sector banks are quite strong. They have a strong political influence. And so I think allegedly they sent some strippers around to Trump's house and said, right, can you not do this for us because we're going to make less money and we kind of like making money. And Trump went, I hear you on that. I like making money too.
I like strippers.
And I like strippers. Thanks for the strippers. And thanks for the money in donations. And there you go. We're gonna carve you out. We're gonna exclude you from that. So the big American banks had to increase their capital requirements, but the community banks got to carve out.
Right. And that's where SVB got into trouble because they had lots of treasury bonds, didn't they? So they had all their capital tied up in treasury bonds,
We're
about halfway through their sort of maturation process, they had to then sell them at a terrible price.
Yeah. I mean, I think Chris Droy gave a great, with this Equity Mates, definitely recommend that one. He gave a great explanation of this. But I think part of it was, like, there was a really easy hedge against that interest rate risk that they ended up taking on that ended up sinking them. There was a really easy way to hedge it. It just was going to cost them money, and they chose to take the gamble and not buy that insurance, buy that hedging insurance. But if they had been subject to the Basel requirements, they probably wouldn't have been able to do that, I think is the reading that I've done on that.
All right, another Jason sent us an email, cve@equitymates.com, and Jason's asking about a bank run in Australia. Thomas, do you reckon a bank run is possible, like what we've seen in the US? Is that something that could happen here in Australia?
It's definitely a black swan event. It's a low probability outcome for sure. It's never zero probability, but it's pretty unlikely. I mean, part of that's with the Australian context. Like JP Morgan released the ranking of the top capitalized banks in the world, and the big four Aussie banks were the 1, 2, 3, and 4 places.
Right.
So I think there's Australian regulatory settings are pretty good on a global scale, which should protect them. We also have the deposit guarantee scheme. So all deposits up to $250,000 in a bank are guaranteed by the government, and that's designed to prevent a run. So people go like, well, if I've got less than $250,000, I know I'm covered. I don't need to pull my money out. The government's going to bail me out. I'm sweet. So that protects that. We also saw with SVB that everyone got made whole. So the government stepped in and went like, doesn't matter how much money you had with SVB, you're going to get it all back.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think that sends a very strong message that the government's like, we're just not going to let banks collapse. You know, we can print money.
We learned that lesson. I feel like we did really, if COVID was good for anything, then it was good for, you know, for printing money and our, like just the willingness that we have now. Drop of a hat. People used to sort of discuss it at length and really labor over that decision.
Yeah.
Now I just feel like the meeting starts running a bit long. People are just like, well, I guess we could always just print money. Fine. Why don't we do that? Let's shut it down. Go to lunch. Good work, everyone.
Yeah, that's what the RBA is like now. It's like, we don't have any biscuits for the meeting. Let's just print some. So I think it's a really low probability outcome here. So the thing with Aussie banks is they're highly exposed to property. They're very like on a global scale. They're very it's really property and daylight second.
Yeah.
So if there was like some cataclysmic event in the property market, that might create a bit of chaos in the banking system. The government would still probably then just step in. Yeah. But that's kind of where I would imagine it coming from, if it was to happen. But very low probability outcome, I imagine.
I feel like Jason's angling to try and create some problems too, because he's called out a couple of banks specifically to say, like, what if we all just took our money out of this bank? Would it help these banks? Like some of the, I'm not going to name them. I think he's just kind of after a bit of a social experiment. So see what would happen, cause a bit of chaos. The old chaos monkey. I don't know if you're familiar with the chaos monkey. The chaos monkey is used to test the resilience of certain technology systems. So Netflix, I think, came up with it. Netflix used to deploy the chaos monkey into their systems to test how well their disaster recovery and business continuity stuff would kick in and whether things kept working. So I think maybe Jason might be angling for a chaos monkey in the banking sector. All right, we're doing your questions here on CVE this week, and this one comes from Quinton, who sent us a message via Instagram or Facebook at CVE Podcast. He says, I need an economist to tell me why these ideas wouldn't work. Number one, make politicians' salary the same as the median income of the country. Thus, if they want a pay rise, they need to actively force wages up. That's one idea. Number two, What if we made politicians use public healthcare, public schools instead of private? Wouldn't that mean that if they want to have better healthcare and education for their families, they have to improve the systems? Also, what if we force executives to cap their salaries at a percentage of their lowest paid worker, say their income cannot be greater than 60% of their lowest paid employees? All right, there's a lot to unpack here. I feel like we're trying to take politicians and execs down a peg or two. I'm not sure this is practically where we want to be. Thomas, can we make politicians' salary the same as the median income of the country?
Definitely possible. Yeah, you could definitely do that.
Yeah,
I like the thrust of that idea. I think it is good.
What is the median income of the country? Do you have any idea?
For a full-time salary, I think it's about 75,000.
Right. What about for politicians that work 3 days a week?
I think they're like around 200 to 250, depending on your ministries and your roles. I think it's I think it's something like that much. It's,
I mean, the obvious problem I can see here is if you make it $75,000 a week to be a politician, and politician's a very broad term, right? It's everyone from a backbencher through to the prime minister. You can't pay the prime minister of the country $75,000 a year. Like, I'm all for, like, taking down politician salaries a little bit, but we still need good people to run the country. Like, you need to make that. I think you need to make the prime minister as still an attractive position that people want. Mm. Otherwise, I don't know, like, you're going to get, like, just people are like, well, it's either running the country or Uber driving. So I do think you need some incentive there for people to want to do better and be the prime minister.
True. But you also, it's kind of like also a kind of role that you don't want someone just doing it for the money.
It's like, no, absolutely.
It's an interesting bind. I mean, I like the idea of forcing them to use public healthcare and public schools. I think that's an excellent idea. I'd love to see that happen. Get them fully invested in the systems they're relying on.
But again, like, so now you've become the prime minister. Mm. You're getting paid $75,000 a year, and you're not allowed in private hospitals. You need a kidney transplant, and now you're on a waiting list. So you need time off. You can't do your job.
Well,
you're getting next to nothing because your income insurance.
I mean, what we're talking about is a quite a radical step towards a more egalitarian society. But also, is that not a good thing? Like the idea that there's two streams of healthcare, and that you can get really good healthcare if you can pay for it, and then you can get substandard healthcare if you can't. Mm. That's not a great outcome. We can do better than that. This day and age, where we're at in economic development, we can do better than that. We don't need a two-tier health system.
Mm, it's everywhere though. Like, I was at Wet n Wild on the Gold Coast. We were buying tickets with the kids. You can buy an express line pass, which just like you literally. We didn't do it just because I couldn't face the line of people like walking past them. And it was crazy expensive. It was like 400. Like the ticket to get in is about $100 or something.
Yeah.
The ticket to skip the queue was another $300 or something on top of that. But it's everywhere. It's the same as why should people get to fly business class just because they can afford to pay it? Like,
Oh, yeah, that's right. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's a radical step towards a more egalitarian society. But I think it's an interest. It's interesting to think about. And it's the nature of capitalism that we have. You know, that private. You know, you can accumulate more wealth, and that more wealth enables you to have benefits that other people don't have access to.
Mm.
Like, you know, you put it like that, it's like, is that really the best we can do? Maybe it's not.
Mm, maybe. I like more the executive salaries to be a percentage of their lowest paid worker. That one I like.
This is an idea. This is an idea that's been around for a while, and listed companies in the US and the UK now have to report on their multiples.
Oh, yeah.
The US average is 354 to 1. So the average CEO in America gets 354 times more money than their lowest paid worker. And this is the thing, that's a massive multiple. You survey Americans and ask them how much more money do you think your CEO is getting? They typically estimate about 10 times more.
Right.
So they massively underestimate how much more they're getting. And it's one of these things where the human ability to understand large numbers just kind of breaks down.
Mm.
If your frontline employee is earning $50,000 a year and your CEO is earning $18 million a year, and there'd be a lot of companies in Australia where that's a reality, the CEO makes that frontline worker's pay in a single day.
Yeah, right.
Like, it seems like it's more, but it's like, wow, like you're earning $50,000 every day you're working.
Mm.
That, and that's what your frontline employee gets in a whole year. So,
and you go, what did you do today? Oh, I had lunch.
Had a
3-hour lunch. I made more than my lowest paid worker at lunch.
At lunch, yeah. Yeah. So there's a push. The Australian Shareholders Association was pushing for this, that Australia should start reporting on this or make it part of a listed company's reporting requirements to report on the multiples. Yeah. But it hasn't got up yet.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. I think, and at least the reporting of it. I think that would be good. All right, yeah. Finally this week on the show, we are answering your questions, and we got an email from Kim, cve@equitymates.com. Kim wanted to thank us for delivering such a great show each week. Well, thank you for tuning in, Kim. Kim did want to call Thomas out in particular for his thoughts about social and environmental factors in the commentary you provide, Tom. So, because Kim has been trying to put my money where my morals are when it comes to their own investing strategy and economic opinions, but find it really hard to find good people to learn from. Longish email, but thank you, Kim. And also, I should call out too that Kim said these questions are for you both, including you, Adam, because I think you're a brighter cookie than you let on. Yes, impressions can be deceiving. But, Thomas, Kim's asking about if there are other commentators with a strong social and environmental awareness, such as yourself. Anything you can recommend?
I think my favourites in the space is Professor Scott Galloway. He's amazing, I think. Like, he's a business school professor, full-throated champion of capitalism, but with full awareness of the inherent contradictions within capitalism and need to make it better. A couple of weeks ago, he wrote this epic piece on quitting, and he's calling out all the tech billionaires for quitting society, not paying taxes, and building bunkers in New Zealand, and saying that's not how we build a great country. You're a bunch of quitters and you need to get on board.
We're going to build a great country. We need to build above the ground.
Yeah. So yeah, right. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. So that was a fantastic piece. And he does a weekly podcast and weekly mail out, and it's all excellent. He's amazing. Okay. I really love what he's bringing. In the Australian space, I really love Laura Tingle, who's, I think, with the AFR and maybe the 7:30 report on the ABC. I kind of love what she's bringing. And I think, like, particularly with the intersection of economics and politics, I think she's the best in the country. Definitely recommend checking her out.
Cool. Kim also was asking about whether it's possible to strike a balance between economics and finance, which focus so much on constant growth and GDP, and social and environmental sustainability, which requires us to stop growing exponentially. And on an individual level, does anything we do make a difference, or should we just say screw it and invest in everything in guns, tobacco and coal? Don't forget alcohol and gambling, Kim, if you're building a portfolio. Thomas, can we find a balance between growth and the environment?
I think I like to believe the answer is yes, but there's a lot of work to do it. And I think one of the things of, like, we're kind of stuck in this debate, and I kind of think there's a deliberate attempt to keep us stuck in the debate about capitalism versus socialism. At a sort of basic level, like, there's not a huge amount of difference in terms of, I think, what the problems that we're facing. I think the problems that we're facing are an accumulation of wealth and ability to hold the system accountable, to inject values into the system, you know, ecological sustainability, good governance, all of that. Capitalism doesn't naturally welcome those things in. It's naturally a bit allergic to them, because it's like, well, wherever you can make money, people will make money, and you got to really lean against that to stop bad outcomes happening. You know, there's a lot of industries that we outlaw, like meth production, for example. You know, at some level, that's the heavy hand of government getting involved in the market and stopping the free market doing what it wants to do. But it's a very reasonable thing to do, and we have to make these choices, and we have to do it collectively. It's a challenge, and we've got to lean against the natural tendencies in capitalism. Capitalism does some things very well, it does some things very poorly, and we need to, like, acknowledge that and lean against that. And I think the way that we do that is with collective action. You know, it's a governance problem. You know, is how do we coordinate ourselves and develop and improve our systems so that we can do that leaning in. And I think like what we can do at an individual level, like a, you know, I'm definitely a fan of, you know, putting your money where your morals are and investing with an ethical screen and investing in companies that are doing good work. But I also think, I think there's a really important role for getting involved in civil society and getting involved in helping humanity with the governance issue, with about how do we develop integral systems that do what they're designed to do, that, you know, make sure everyone's getting a good deal in the story, no one's getting left behind, we're leaning against the worst excesses of capitalism, you know. And there's a lot of work to do there. Like, you know, take the issue of political donations, for example. Like, it's still, I believe in 20 years we will look back at this era and think it was just crazy that we let wealthy people donate money to politicians and then tell them what to do. Like, that's kind of crazy. But that's kind of the reality we've had. This reality we've always had since feudal times. We got to keep, you know, dragging humanity closer to that thing of working in the collective good and having systems that promote the social good. So I think like if you know, if you're looking for, you know, an action point, getting involved in civil society, and the more we get involved and get engaged, the better. You know, that there's that saying, like, you get the leaders that you deserve. So if you get involved and get engaged in politics and support governance, that better governance where you can, that's a way to create a better society. And that, but it has to be a team effort. We have to all be doing that.
Yeah, no, well said. Well, there you go. So I think, yeah, if you want to legalise meth production too, then talk to your local member. That does us. I think we all need a couple of weeks off after that. Thank you so much for all of your emails and your messages that you send through. I know we didn't get to all of them. There's still a couple of more there floating around we couldn't fit in this week. But, yeah, really appreciate it. Little note for future, if you could try and keep them nice and short, because I don't like reading, but it also makes it much easier for me to get the questions right for Thomas. But, yeah, really do appreciate it. We appreciate you guys tuning in each and every week. For us, we're off on a couple of weeks break. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Yeah, so good luck with the interest rates tomorrow. Hopefully, maybe we'll get a pause. Fingers crossed. But that is all for us for now. It is bye for now.
You have been listening to an Equity Mates Media production. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general advice only and has not taken into account your personal financial circumstances, needs, or objectives. Before acting on general advice, you should consider if it is relevant to your needs and read the relevant product disclosure statement. And if you're unsure, please speak to a financial professional. The hosts of this podcast and their guests may have positions in the companies mentioned. Equity Mates Media operates under an Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.